we spent the last class before the exam discussing how protein synthesis works and how RNA makes protein. And what I want to do today is wrap that up. How does RNA make protein? And then I want to talk a little bit about mistakes in DNA, RNA, and protein synthesis. And then we're going to talk about regulation in prokaryotes. So we say DNA makes RNA makes protein. What do we mean by RNA makes protein? We mean that you have a messenger RNA. And it contains the information, so that the information goes from DNA to line up the bases in RNA and from RNA to line up the amino acids in protein. So that's one thing it means. That the RNA is the template to line up the amino acids. But we all know by now that if you put messenger RNA in a test tube, you don't get any protein, even if you have amino acids. You need some other RNA. You need RNA in addition to its information capacity as part of the tools to do this. What do you need? What kind of RNA? You need transfer RNA. So you're going to need a whole set of transfer RNAs, as we've just enough to recognize all of the codons. As we've explained, that's about 30 different ones. Any other kind of RNA? We're going to need ribosomal RNA. And there are, depending in prokaryotes, three kinds, in eukaryotes, four. We're going to need enough of them to make at least one ribosome. Now, if I put all of this together, messenger RNA, loaded transfer RNA, ribosomal RNA, would I get protein? Well, of course, we need proteins, enzymes, to work this out, in addition to the non-enzymatic proteins of the ribosome. But to need protein to do something is not unusual. That's the general state of affairs. So the reason that people mention the RNA is because the RNA is unusual. In this process, you don't just need enzymes. You also need RNA. Now, in order to pull this off, what do you need in the DNA? We all know that you need the section of the DNA that codes for the messenger RNA. You need what we have called the gene for the message in question, which is actually the gene for the protein that we're talking about. So we need that. We need the gene for the protein, which acts by being transcribed into message. Do we need to code for anything else? Yeah, where did the tRNA come from? All RNA is made from a DNA template. So there have to be genes for the protein, but there also have to be genes for the transfer RNAs. So you need something on the order of 30 genes. tRNA genes. Now, what happens to this RNA? You transcribe it, and then it folds up. Each one of these folds up first into the clover leaf, then into the L, and acts as a tRNA. You don't have an RNA to code for the RNA. The RNA comes right off the DNA. So we have to have a whole bunch of these. Do we need anything else to pull this off? Where do we get the ribosomes from? And the ribosomal RNA? Where does ribosomal RNA come from? Somewhere on the DNA. So in addition to genes for ribosomal RNA, of course we need the genes for tRNA, we also need the genes for ribosomal RNA. So we have to add three or four of those. So they make their RNA, but then that has to make a ribosome. So that has to meet the proteins. The rRNA has to meet the ribosomal proteins, and then finally you get a ribosome. So in order to make our one protein, we needed to use the gene for the message, the gene for that protein, the genes for the transfer RNA, the genes for the ribosomal RNA, and though I didn't write it here, the genes for the messages for the ribosomal proteins. You need all of that to make one protein. Now, we have gone here about the number of different kinds, but of course, you don't usually have one of each tRNA. You have many copies of each kind, many ribosomes, etc. But now I want to ask you, suppose you wanted to make a different protein. This is protein A. Suppose you want to make protein B. What do you have to change? Can you use the same ribosomal RNA? Same ribosomes? Yeah. Any ribosome can translate any message. Can you use the same transfer RNA? Yeah, it reloads, as we asked you on the exam. It reloads, picks up amino acids, and gets used over and over again. What about the message? If you want to make a different protein, that's what you need differently. So you would have a different gene. Say the gene for protein A, for protein B, would be read out to make a new message to make protein B. So if you want to make a new protein, you need a new message, but you can use over all the other parts. So people say the message is like the software. The ribosomes, ribosomal RNA, tRNA, other proteins are the hardware. So this is a complicated system to set up, but once you set it up, all you have to do is change the message to change the protein. And in bacteria, I want to remind you that transfer RNA and ribosomal RNA and most proteins have a relatively long half-life. Once they're made, they're used over and over until they wear out. But messenger RNA has a relatively short half-life. It's used a relatively small number of times and lasts only a few minutes, probably, in bacteria. And so the supply of messenger is constantly being replaced and renewed to fit the needs of the moment. So in summary, really, you need RNA and protein to make protein. And we've discussed the basics of the various parts. And if you take molecular biology, you learn about the details of what each thing does. And much more detail is in your book, especially in Becker, if you're interested. And I want to leave this now and talk about the issue of mutations. So before I leave this, are there any questions about any of this? Yes. Okay, her question is, the proteins in the ribosome, is ribosomal RNA the message to make these ribosomal proteins? And the answer is no. So that you need, if this is a ribosomal protein gene, it has to be transcribed to make a message. Using pre-existing ribosomes, you make ribosomal protein, and then those proteins meet the ribosomal RNA, and finally you fold and you make a ribosomal subunit, and two subunits come together and you make a ribosome. Yes, in the back?
If the supply of the mRNA is replenished every few minutes, does that mean that the fastest the cells respond is on the order of minutes?
His question is, how fast can you switch gears in a cell? I said minutes, but I suspect for bacteria it's more like seconds. Higher organisms work slower. But the amount of, you can switch gears in a very short time relative to the lifetime of a bacterium, the generation time. Yes?
So you're saying that is actually mRNA for the ribosome protein, and that actually is mRNA, and that makes the proteins better.
So we're saying that this, okay, so these are two separate RNAs. Yeah, one.
When you say that the half-life of tmRNA and rRNA is relatively long compared to mRNA? Are we talking on the order of like many, many generations of mRNA?
The question is, what is the real half-life of transfer RNA? And I can't tell you the answer. But the point really is that tRNA and ribosomal RNA are much, much more long-lived than a message. That's really the point. Whether these last generations or hundreds, I don't know. Two more, and then we're going to go on. Yes?
We're talking about everything that is necessary to sort of make one protein in this situation. In the real reality of the cell, and knowing about polysomes, how realistic is
it? Okay, his question is, we're talking about the bare minimum here, but what's really going on in a cell? In a real cell, you have umpteen ribosomes, umpteen copies of each kind of tRNA, umpteen messages, all working at once. Yes, what was the question in the back? Yeah.
So I guess tRNA and rRNA genes are the same in everyone. So is that, can you use those genes for barcoding? Are they different in other species?
The question is, can you use tRNA genes for barcoding? I suspect, that is, are they different enough from species to species to be useful? I know that's not the gene that they use. They use ribosomal RNA a lot. But I don't know if, I don't think they use transfer RNA. Okay, so assuming then we've discussed replication, transcription, and translation, how DNA makes DNA, DNA makes RNA, and RNA makes protein. Well, we've discussed how it's supposed to work, but we all know that nothing is perfect. So what I want to consider now are, what are the consequences of mistakes? So we actually could look at our picture over here. If the ribosome and the transfer RNA, etc., the translation machine makes a mistake, it means that you get a protein which, say, has one wrong amino acid in it. Or you stop making this chain too soon and then you start on the next one. Now, how serious is this? Here we have one crummy molecule of protein. What about the next molecule of protein? If there is nothing wrong with the machinery, and this is just an oops, as happens to everything and everybody, then we assume that although we made a mistake here, the next molecule of protein will be okay. And we'll have a small error rate, every thousandth or millionth, whatever, protein molecule will be bad, and everything else will be okay. This is not considered too serious, as long as it doesn't happen too often. And in cells, the error rate is low, but not non-existent. What if you make a mistake in transcription? So that, let's say, a molecule of message has one of the bases wrong. What are the consequences? Well, if we mess up a coding base, we mess it up properly, so to speak, we could change one amino acid. And in fact, we could change a molecule of protein. Well, we change only one molecule of protein. Remember, polysomes, etc.? Multiple ribosomes are going to go down this message. So we're going to get more than one bad molecule of protein. Are we ever going to make good protein again? Well, we are, because the message is going to be replaced. So a mistaken transcription on message is worse. We're not going to get one bad molecule of protein, but many. But eventually this message will get degraded, actually fairly soon, and we'll replace it with good message, because there was an oops in making the message, and we don't expect that to happen again. So as long as we don't make too many mistakes in transcription, we're going to have enough good protein, so a little bad protein doesn't matter. Let's take it back one more. Suppose you make a mistake during replication. So here you have your two strands of DNA, and they come apart. I'll draw them vertically this time. And you put in the right companion to one, but you make a mistake, and you put in the wrong base in the companion to the other. And again, this is an oops. Well, first of all, can this cell function? Well, it depends. Or maybe it depends whether you've messed up the sense strand or the template strand. But in any case, you still have a good copy of the information. And this mistake is actually repairable. And many cells have enzymes, all cells have enzymes for repairing damaged DNA. So there's a good chance this will get repaired. On the other hand, suppose it doesn't. It escapes, this mistake escapes the surveillance machinery, and we replicate the DNA again. So now we take it apart. And the strand that was unaltered codes for a complement. You have one good molecule. But now the strand that's altered is going to code for its correct partner, which is going to be different. So, for example, if this was AT, and now we have, say, TG, this is going to be GC, while this one, AT. Now, the difference is, what happens, what about this cell? Does it still have a good copy of information? It no longer has any information, any copy of the original. It has been changed. And now every time it replicates, it will pass on the change to all of its offspring. So this is called a mutation. A change in the protein is called, a mistake in protein synthesis is called a mistake. A mistake in RNA synthesis is called a mistake. But a mistake in DNA synthesis that doesn't get fixed is called a mutation. And the cell that carries it is called a mutant. Now, the terminology that people use here is they say at this stage, when both strands are altered, they say the mutation is fixed. That doesn't mean corrected. That means permanently in place. So the mutation now is beyond repair. It is fixed or set. And you're stuck. Now, mutations are serious because the changed genetic information is passed on generation after generation, while mistakes in transcription and translation are not perpetuated to the next generation. Now, I want to say a little bit about mutations, about the terminology. What kind of mistakes could you make? Well, you could say, I just change one base as I did there to another. So let's say AAA to AAT. Now, this is called a substitution. You just change one base for another. Now, as you will see when you do the problems, if not this week, next week, that sometimes this makes a difference and sometimes it doesn't. How could it not make a difference? Remember degeneracy? These could code for the same amino acid, in which case you have changed the genotype. You have changed it, but you have not changed the phenotype or the properties of the organism. On the other hand, if this codon codes for a different amino acid, then you may change the phenotype, because changing the amino acid may change the function of the protein and change the appearance or phenotype of the behavior of the organism. And we'll talk more about that as we go into formal genetics. Now, another possibility is what people call a deletion or an insertion. And that's where you put an extra base in. So this becomes, that would be an insertion, where it becomes four A's instead of three, or a deletion, where you take out one A and it becomes two instead of three. Which is worse, an insertion of one or an insertion of three bases? One is worse, because remember reading frames? Remember, we'll take a famous example. I'm going to write it up here. Instead of using A, G, C's, and T's, I'll use three-letter words. But like the genetic code, it has no commas and no spaces. So here we have the fat cat ate the rat. So if we have a substitution, say, we change this to C, and then it becomes the cat ate the rat, which makes no sense. But we've only messed up one word. But what if we insert a C here? Then it becomes the fuka at, the fuka at cat. No, I didn't do it right. I didn't want this one. So we leave the F and we put in the C. It becomes the fuka, tuka, tat, if, at, which sounds vaguely obscene. But it certainly doesn't mean anything. Okay. So on the other hand, what if we put in three letters? I'll make them up. CTF, because they don't mean anything. Then it would be, I would mess up one word. It would be the, F-C-T, fat cat ate the rat. So if I shift it by three, I've added or removed one codon, but all the words before and after are okay. This kind of mistake, where you put in one or two, is called, or delete one or two, is called a frame shift. When we reassemble your exams, this is what we always worry about. We have piles of page one, piles of page two, piles of page three, piles of page four. Now, when we reassemble them, if we get one off, all the other papers after that are screwed up. Think about it. It almost always happens, but we catch it. Okay, so frame shifts are serious, and they can really have serious consequences. Now, there's one other thing I want to mention. Whether you have a substitution or a frame shift, sometimes, instead of converting AAA into, say, AAT, you change it to TAA, which is UAA in the message. Now, when you change from AAA to AAT, I think you change which amino acid you code for. But when you go from AAA to UAA, you go from a coding codon to a stop codon, which is more serious. Because if you put a stop codon in the middle of your message, you'll make a short protein instead of a long one. So this kind of change, where you get a premature stop, is often called nonsense. While if you change from a codon coding for one amino acid to a codon for a different amino acid, that's called missense. Now, the problems in problem set 7, I believe, at the end, give you a chance to try out various cases of this, and so does the problem, the recitation problems for next week. Why do we talk so much about mutations? You probably realized already they're in the problem book. Why do we bring this up? Well, mutations are the ultimate source of all variation in the genetic material. And the variation, depending on how you look at it, is either good news or bad news. It's good news in the sense that it supplies the raw material for selection, which allows evolutionary change. So that there is adaptation, the population changes to fit new conditions. You couldn't do that if there weren't variation. On the other hand, variation from individual to individual and from species to species, especially in areas that don't make any difference in phenotype, those are the basis of all forensics and identifications. So there are variations that affect function, which improve it, variations which have no effect on function, but are useful to us, and then there are variations that ruin function. That's the bad news. And those variants are what we recognize as genetic diseases. Now, whether variation is good news or bad news often depends on your point of view. HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, is very variable. This is bad news from our point of view because it outwits the immune system and replicates at the expense of the infected person. This is good news from the point of view of the virus. This is how the virus manages to reproduce and survive because it evades the immune system. So it depends how you're looking at it. Good news, bad news. There is another very important reason for talking about mutations, and that is that they are used experimentally to figure things out. You've already met examples of that, and we'll meet more today. That a mutation allows you to change or to knock out the function of a protein. You change the gene, and the corresponding product is altered, and then you can see what happens. How does that change the phenotype, or does it? And that is often how you figure out the job of a gene and a protein. So you will meet examples of that both in the problems and in your reading and hopefully in something we'll get to today. So I want to switch gears again and talk about regulation in prokaryotes. So before I do that, are there any questions about this so far? Okay. Now for this part, you're going to need the handout for today. So if you didn't get one, there's some here and there's some in the back. First, let's consider how we think things should work, and then we'll see if they really do. Let's consider three kinds of enzymes. And these three are actually in that little table on side A, underneath the graphs. We want to consider three enzymes, which are beta-galactosidase, tryptophan synthetase, and any glycolytic enzyme. When do you need the enzymes of glycolysis? Maybe I could ask it the other way. When don't you need the enzymes of glycolysis? Virtually never. Those enzymes are needed almost all the time. Therefore, you would expect that these enzymes would be made more or less the same amount all the time. On the other hand, what about beta-galactosidase? Its job is the first step in the use of lactose. Lactose is a dimer of glucose and galactose. Now, we're talking about bacterial enzymes here and how bacteria do it. How higher organisms do it is a little different, and we'll get to that another time. But the first step in metabolism of lactose is to split the glucose from the galactose, or to hydrolyze the dimer. And then the glucose goes through glycolysis, as we know. The galactose, which is an isomer of glucose, is converted to glucose, and then it goes through the same pathway. So the critical first step is breaking this bond, and that's what beta-galactosidase, one of the world's most famous enzymes, does. When do you need beta-galactosidase? If you are growing in minimal medium with glucose as the carbon source, do you need beta-galactosidase? No. The only time you need it is when lactose is a major carbon source and energy source. If you're growing on lactose in the medium, you absolutely need that enzyme. If you're growing on glucose or galactose or fructose, you don't need it at all. So you need it when lactose is present. That would make sense. Now, what about tryptophan synthetase? Beta-galactosidase is involved in a catabolic pathway, a breakdown pathway. Tryptophan synthetase is involved in an anabolic pathway, synthesis of tryptophan. So there's a series of reactions that lead to the amino acid tryptophan. And the enzyme tryptophan synthetase catalyzes the last step in that process. When do you need this enzyme? When TRP is present or TRP is absent? If TRP is present in the medium, do you need to make it? No. So do you need this enzyme? So when do you need this enzyme? TRP present or absent? It's when it's absent. So cells would save energy if they only made tryptophan synthetase when they needed to make tryptophan, and they only made beta-galactosidase when they needed to break down lactose. Is this the way it is? Well, those graphs on the top tell you what the results of experiments are. So let's look at that. So, in the case of lactose, but I now realize I really want to write it so we can also look at our table. So I'm going to write it over here instead. So this is time, and this is enzyme per cell on the other axis. Suppose you have a culture, a bacteria, and there's no lactose. The amount of beta-galactosidase per cell is low. But when you add lactose to the medium, then the amount of beta-galactosidase per cell rises. And it stays high until you either remove or use up the lactose. So when you take away the lactose, the amount per cell falls off. Now, this, in other words, is the way you would expect. In the presence of lactose, they make the enzyme to break it down. When it's gone, they stop it. So what's going on here is, what is, if you look at your little table here, you see we have, what is the small molecule you add that triggers some action? That's called an effector, because it has an effect. Then in the case of beta-galactosidase, it's lactose. When you add lactose, you turn on enzyme synthesis. Now, what do you call this? This turn-on is called induction. Or the other way that people say it is, synthesis of the enzyme is inducible, as it says on your handout. And the small molecule that triggered everything, the effector, is called an inducer. Now, in contrast, what happens if you have a culture which is growing without tryptophan, and you add tryptophan? That's the picture on the right. So now we're measuring enzyme per cell again, but this time we're measuring tryptophan synthetase with time. So if you have a culture that has no tryptophan, the enzyme level will be actually high. And when you add the tryptophan, the level falls off. But then, when the tryptophan is either removed or used up, the cells start to make enzyme again. You notice this is exactly the converse of the situation. And so people talk about it in an equivalent way. Instead of calling it induction or turn on, they call it repression or turn off. Because enzyme synthesis stops instead of starts. And the small molecule effector this time is tryptophan. What do you think the small molecule should be called? If you have repressible synthesis of tryptophan synthetase, and it's an example of repression triggered by acting tryptophan, what should you call tryptophan? You'd think you would call it the repressor, right? By the time they got to this, they had already named something else the repressor. So it's called the co-repressor instead of the repressor. The repressor is the name of a protein involved here, which we'll explain later. So the inducer and the co-repressor are equivalent. They are the respective effector, which triggers either induction or repression, either the turn on or turn off of an inducible or repressible enzyme, such as these two. So before any go any further, what do you need repression for? Haven't we ever heard of something else that turns things off when you don't need them? Remember end product inhibition or feedback repression or feedback inhibition? That looks at first sight like it does the same thing. And there's something called feedback activation, which is similar to induction. Well, since we talked mostly about feedback inhibition, repression, I want to compare feedback inhibition to repression. Inhibition and repression in English have similar meanings, but in molecular biology they mean something quite different. So you want to look at that pictures now on the bottom of your handout, which compare feedback inhibition and repression. So the example we'll use is tryptophan synthesis. Enzyme 3 or tryptophan synthetase is needed for this step. A different enzyme for this one, a different enzyme for this one. So to make tryptophan, you need at least three enzymes working in series to convert X to Y, Y to Z, and Z to tryptophan. Now, this system is subject to feedback inhibition. So if that's right, what would we expect tryptophan to do? Which step or steps are going to be blocked by tryptophan? It's always the first critical one. So you would expect tryptophan to come back and inhibit. Now, on your handout, you have an arrow with a minus. Another way of symbolizing that, which is very common, is this block symbol. It means the same thing, inhibition. Now, what are the features here? They're summarized in the little table below, that this is an example of feedback inhibition. And what did we change? Did we change the amount of enzyme? Enzyme synthesis? None of that. We just changed the working of the enzyme that's already there. We changed what is called enzyme activity, not enzyme amount. Now, this is pretty fast. That's one of its advantages. But which enzymes were affected? Notice just one. And did I, if I don't need the enzymes anymore, did I stop making them? No, I just inhibited them for the moment. So if I'm not going to need tryptophan for a long time, I'm going to waste energy making these enzymes and then blocking them from working. Repression does the opposite. So what repression does is to affect synthesis of the enzymes. So if we have a gene for enzyme 1 and a gene for enzyme 2 and a gene for enzyme 3, what repression does is to block what is called gene expression. Meaning, the gene is there, but it doesn't make its product. In fact, what happens is you block transcription. No transcription, no message, no protein. So you're affecting this time not enzyme activity, but enzyme synthesis, and therefore enzyme amount. Now, you may have noticed in these pictures that decay of enzyme is slower than production of enzyme. And that's explained here. Why is it so slow to get rid of the enzyme? Is that if you block gene expression, no more transcription, no more message, no more protein made, what happens to your old protein? It just sits there. So how do you get rid of it? Notice these graphs are enzyme per cell. So the cells continue to divide, but the amount of enzyme in the culture doesn't change. So the same amount of enzyme is parceled out first to 2 cells and then to 4 and then to 8. So this phenomenon is a dilution of pre-existing enzyme. But what about when the enzyme goes up? Why is it so fast? If I stop blocking the gene, I will make message and make protein, and that will happen quickly. So this is protein synthesis. We're actually making new protein and increasing the protein per cell, while here we are just diluting the amount per cell, but the total amount doesn't change. So that explains the fast versus slow. In terms of blockage, feedback inhibition is very fast. It shuts down the enzyme that I have here. It shuts down the nozzle on the pathway, and it prevents production. When I have repression and I prevent further synthesis, it takes a while for the enzyme per cell to fall. I don't make any new enzyme, but the enzyme that's there persists. So this is much slower. But one big difference is how many enzymes are affected. In feedback inhibition, we just affect number 1. the committed step or the critical step. But in repression, all three of these, all three genes make less message, and therefore you make less of all the proteins. So you have all of them, all of the enzymes stop being made. Now, why do you need both of these? People often think of this as a coarse control and a fine control. Controlling the amount of enzyme saves you energy over the long run, but it's a pretty coarse adjustment. It's like buying new air conditioners or selling the old ones. But feedback inhibition is more like adjusting the knob on the air conditioners that you already have, and that's a fine control. And that's faster, but it doesn't save you extra air conditioners. So cells, bacteria, have both of these systems for regulating many processes. And now what we want to do, since we've talked about feedback inhibition before, is we now want to look more closely at repression, or for that matter, induction, and see how it works. It turns out that repression and induction both work in extremely similar ways. Today we're going to focus on induction. And then next time, we will come back and review it and discuss repression. And the very first thing, really, that we want to explain is an important feature of repression. One of the critical features of induction or repression is that you affect all of the enzymes in the pathway at the same time. You don't just make beta-galactosidase, you make all the other enzymes you need to handle lactose. You don't just make tryptophan synthetase, but all the enzymes in the pathway. So this is called coordinate control. Control enzyme production by all these genes simultaneously? And the answer to that is on the other side of your handout, on the upper left picture. When you consider all the genes that make the proteins to handle beta-galactosidase for breaking up lactose, converting galactose to glucose, etc., those genes are actually next to each other on the chromosome. So I've called them here S1, S2, and S3. S stands for structural gene, meaning each of these codes for the amino acid sequence in a peptide that is going to be an enzyme and do something. These genes are not involved in regulation. They are involved in coding for enzymes. So we're going to get three enzymes out of this, which are drawn down here, one from each gene. But now we know that the way induction and repression works, we're either going to make a lot of all three proteins or a little of all three. That's what we mean by coordinate control. And the way that's pulled off is by having one messenger RNA that codes for all three. Now, the point being that if you make that message, you'll get all three proteins, and if you don't, you won't get any of them. This kind of message is called a polycistronic message. Cistron is another word for gene. Gene is hard to define. Cistron means a unit of function. It's a way of defining gene. So this is a polycistronic mRNA, meaning it contains the information from more than one gene. In this case, three. Now, in bacteria, because messenger RNA is very short-lived, controlling the amount of message is sufficient to control the amount of protein made. The process of translation itself is not usually regulated. So what we have here is what is called transcriptional control. Transcriptional control. control is at this point at transcription, not at translation per se. But controlling the amount of message actually controls the amount of protein. Now, in eukaryotes, it's a little more complicated, and sometimes these two processes, which take place in different compartments of the cell, are regulated separately, and we'll talk about that next semester when we talk about eukaryotic regulation. But in bacteria, these two processes take place in the same compartment. There is no nucleus, and they are actually coupled to each other, and the supply of message determines the rate of protein synthesis. Now, what are you going to call this? Oh, I forgot something. How can you see to it that there's only one message for all three genes? How many promoters does the system have? It has only one. Promoter, remember, is the stretch on the DNA that binds the RNA polymerase and says start here. So we start transcription here, essentially here, and end it here. So this is one promoter shared by all three. And there is some kind of terminator or stop transcription signal at the other end. So these three genes share a common promoter. So that's why you get one message. Now this brings up the whole issue of punctuation. How many kinds of punctuation have we talked about? If this is the DNA, it has in it the signals for transcription, replication, and translation. How many signals for start replication does this need? How many origins?
One.
So we can start somewhere, which is the origin, two forks, one each way. They join up, one origin required. How many promoters? This is a reasonable DNA from, say, a bacterium or a virus. How many different messenger RNAs are you likely to make? One? More than one. So actually, you're going to need multiple promoters. The bigger this is, the more proteins it codes for, probably the more promoters. So there are going to be more promoters than there are origins. But what about start and stop codons? In a single message, do we have one start and one stop? Well, not this one. You may start transcription here, but you start translation three times. Once, twice, three times. And you stop translation one, two, three times. So the signals for translation are going to be even more numerous than the signals for transcription. Now, I want to remind you, if this is the part corresponding to structural gene 1, this first start codon, in this, let's just say in this whole message, there's going to be a section here on the 5' end that is not translated. The AUG to start the first protein is not going to be on the absolute end. So you're going to have an untranslated 5' region, and then you're going to have, or a leader, and then you're going to have a start signal and a stop signal. Start codon, stop codon. Then you might have a short section, and then you're going to have start again, stop again, start again, stop again, and then you're going to have a trailer, a short section on the 3' end that's not translated. These untranslated regions are much longer and extensive in eukaryotes, but prokaryotes have them also. Okay. So that's our basic setup here that explains coordinate control. Except, how do you name this? You merely have a unit here which is larger than a gene. This is a unit which is transcribed together, and this is called an operon. Biologists and geneticists are very fond of ons. Notice the operon and the cistron. And you'll meet more. And the codon. Now, the whole point of induction and repression is that you can turn the whole system off. In the case of induction, we consider it's off and then you can turn it on. In the case of repression, we consider it's off, but you can turn it on again. So that's the on condition. How do you get an off condition? So the operon on the other side of your handout, on the left, is an off operon. Excuse me, on the right. So on your handout, here's our operon again, with the promoter and our three structural genes. But in order to turn it off, you now need an additional feature. That is another section of the DNA which serves as a binding site for a protein. You may remember when I brought the Zoob's DNA model, it was clear from that there are grooves in the DNA, and what is exposed in that groove is a sequence. So that you can have proteins that bind specifically to certain sequences in the DNA and not others. So DNA polymerase binds to the origin. RNA polymerase binds to promoters. This section here is another regulatory site to which a regulatory protein binds and shuts down the operon. And this sequence here, to which the protein sticks, is called the operator. And the protein that sticks to it is the repressor. To be careful, some people call it repressor protein, so you won't mix it up with the co-repressor. Other people call it the regulator protein, because you have a protein like this, whether the operon is inducible or repressible. But repressor is the common name, because what is the job of this protein? Is it to turn it off, or is it to turn the operon on? The job of this protein is to sit on the operator and shut things down. And that's one of the reasons it is known as repressor, because it represses as in turns off. Now, each operon has its own operator-repressor combination. A different one is used in every operon. But what each of these has in common is this protein, the repressor, is made all the time. This is an allosteric protein that has two shapes. One of them sits on the operator and shuts down the operon. The other one falls off the operator. It either goes somewhere else in the DNA or it goes into the cytoplasm, but it leaves the operator. Now, in your handout, I've consistently drawn a rectangle and a circle. In the middle panel on your handout, they're drawn up and down instead of right and left. But these are the two forms of repressor. As we said, it's an allosteric protein. Now, these are just symbols. But the reason I pick these symbols is to imply that the rectangle sticks to the DNA and the circle does not. So the protein is around all the time. It's which state it's in determines whether the operon is off or the operon is on. I have a question for you. Where does the repressor protein come from? I said, poof, let there be repressor protein. And I had a repressor protein. And I had an operator. But where do I get the repressor protein? If there's a protein, what else is there? There is a gene on the DNA coding for it. So I'll add that over here. And that has to be transcribed, then you have to make repressor protein. that is shown actually on the next panel, that picture. Okay. What about this gene? Does it have an operator or a promoter? And this is a question I want you to think about for a minute and maybe discuss it with the people next to you and come to a consensus. Does this gene have an operator and does it have a promoter? What do you think? It's awfully quiet in here. You to close your eyes for this one. Do you need a repressor for it to be an operon? Well, this system will not work without a repressor, but the question of whether you call this part of the operon or separate is debatable and depends on the context. Because these two, the promoter and the operator, must be next to the structural genes they control. They cannot be somewhere else. But what about the repressor gene? Does it have to be next to the other genes? It doesn't, because it makes a protein that can then diffuse through the cell. So sometimes this is considered not considered part of the operon. Okay, but now let's take a vote. For the repressor gene itself, close your eyes for a second. How many people think it has no promoter? Has a promoter? Undecided. Okay, what about an operator? How many people think it has no operator? Has an operator? Undecided. Okay, you can open your eyes. People were overwhelmingly in favor of a promoter and no operator. Although there were people who voted the other way and there were people who were undecided, most people said yes, it has a promoter, and no, it has no operator. Now, why would it have a promoter? Will somebody defend that? Why does it have a promoter?
You need to know where to start transcription.
You need to know where to start transcription. Is there any gene coding for a protein that has no promoter? Well, if it does, it's a dead gene. In order for a gene to be transcribed and code for a protein and get the protein to be made, you have to have a promoter. Okay, promoter. But what about operator? Why no operator? What did I say about this protein? Is it made constitutively, inducibly, or repressibly? Is its synthesis constitutive, inducible, or repressible? Constitutive means made all the time. Synthesis of this protein is constitutive. It is made all the time. It's the state it's in that matters, not its presence or absence. So, do we have to make the message all the time? We do. Do we want to shut down transcription here? We do not. So, in fact, the genius of this system is that this protein, this gene, has no operator. If this gene for the regulatory protein was in turn regulated, who would regulate it? And who would regulate that? So somewhere down the line, somebody has to have no operator. And in this system, it's not very far down the line. The point here is that this protein, the regulator protein or the repressor protein, is made all the time, but the state it's in is influenced by, say, tryptophan or lactose, depending on which operon it works in. So let's see then, if it has no operator, how do you get from off to on, or vice versa? The idea is that the effector, the small molecule, shifts the equilibrium between sticky, operon off, and not sticky, operon on. So if we have an inducer, we're turning the system on. So which way will the inducer shift the equilibrium? The inducer is going to shift it to the right, and the co-repressor is going to shift it to the left. So I said today we want to focus on induction. So we want to consider today how this works. Now, just to sort of say this in semi-3D, we're saying that this is the repressor protein. And it's allosteric, so it has two slightly different forms. It's really a much more complicated protein with subunits, but you get the idea. So this is the effector. And the idea is that there is some spot in the protein that fits this effector. And when the effector binds, it alters the shape of the protein. So that the empty is one shape and the full is another. Now, if this is lactose, and this is the repressor of the lac operon, they have to fit together. So what about the trip operon? Can it use the same repressor? It has to have a different one that fits tryptophan. So each operon has its own repressor. So the repressor, say, for the trip operon would be a different protein, and in fact, it would bind a different effector, tryptophan. But now we have these two, right? One is the trip repressor, one is the lac repressor. Each of these binds a different effector, lactose, tryptophan. What about the DNA they stick to? Do they stick to the same DNA? What do you call the DNA where a repressor binds? You call it the operator. So one of these sticks to the operator of the lac operon, and one of them sticks to the operator of the trip operon. So each of these is under separate control. When you think about it, you want, when you flip the toaster switch, you do not want the microwave to go on, and vice versa. So you have to have two separate systems, one for switching the microwave off and on appropriately, and one for the toaster, and that's what we have here. So let's look at how induction works in the lac operon. We sort of diagrammed that out in the middle panel. And the idea is that, of course, the repressor gene is transcribed and you make repressor. No inducer. So the repressor just goes and sits on the operator. So in the case of induction, if I write it again, in the case of induction, this is the form that sits on the operator. Is it with the bound effector or without? When inducer comes along, lactose, which way do we want this to go? We want it to go to the right. So the square is empty. No inducer sticks to operator. But when the inducer comes along and binds in its site, that changes the site, the shape of our allosteric protein, and now it no longer fits on the operator. So in this case, the empty form is a rectangle and the full form is a circle. As we'll see next time in repression, which is full and which is empty is reversed. So I've drawn it here this way. Now, when lactose comes along, it will fit into the binding site in the repressor protein. The repressor protein will fall off. And now we will have the other case. So we have an operator here. We have a repressor gene. And we have repressor. But if there is no inducer, the repressor is going to go... Did I say it the right way? No, yes. If there, this is the case where you have inducer. Over here on the right, there's no inducer. Repressor protein sits on the operator, operon off. Add inducer, repressor protein changes shape and comes off operon. And so the picture would look like this. A repressor protein is present, but it isn't doing anything. And so the operon is now on. Okay. Now, exactly how the repressor protein gets on and off the DNA is complex, and it's discussed a little bit in your notes. And I'm not going to go into it, but I want to talk about one more thing. Remember we mentioned mutants? If you have a nonsense mutation, a premature stop, or you have a frame shift, you get proteins that don't work at all. What will happen if the repressor protein has, the gene for the repressor protein has one of these drastic mutations and the protein does not work at all? What will be the consequence? Remember we said mutants are how you figure things out? This whole thing was actually figured out by analyzing mutants. Now, what we've done is tell you what the mechanism is and now you try the mutants out on a problem instead of the other way around. But this is actually how it was done. What would happen if you got rid of the repressor protein? Would this be shut offable? You wouldn't be able to shut it off anymore. In fact, it would become constitutive. And I have one more question for you. Is there any other kind of mutation that can make this constitutive? One is a mutation in the repressor gene, which knocks out the repressor. So just take 30 seconds here to answer this, and then we'll sort of wrap it up and give back the exams. So, is there any other way to make it constitutive? Okay, do I have a suggestion? How else could we, is there a mutation we could put somewhere else in the DNA? We take this one away. This one's okay. We are making repressor protein, but the system is still constitutive, stuck in the on position. How is this possible? What do you think?
There's two ways, I think. One way could be that repressor protein,
so one possibility is the binding site in for the but that would be a mutation in the repressor gene, but changing its properties instead of knocking it out completely. That would do it.
Or at the operator, and then that would mean...
So remember, this is a two-part switch. Either part is missing, no results. So if you had a mutation in the operator such that the repressor protein did not stick to it, also you would get constitutive. So there's two kinds of constitutive mutants, those which mess up the operator and those which mess up the repressor protein. Now, many of the problems in your book ask, what happens if you put together a normal and a mutant or two mutants? Now, why is this a problem? How many copies of the genetic information do normal bacteria have? One. Bacteria have a single chromosome. They are what is known as haploid. This is in distinction from you. You are diploid. You have two copies of the genetic information, one from each parent. But bacteria have only one. So how can bacteria have two copies of anything? The answer is that bacterial cells, in addition to their big fat chromosome, can have a mini chromosome. And this is called a plasmid. So you can have the regular copy of your operon or your gene on the chromosome, and then you can have a second copy on the plasmid. And now each one is doing its thing. What will happen to the cell? If you say put two constitutives together or a constitutive and a wild type, a normal, what will happen? Will you get constitutive? Will you get repressible? Will you get inducible? That's the question. Now, next time we will wrap this up with a bit more, talking about the role of promoters, and also the question of how do you get an extra copy of the genes on a plasmid. We'll talk about that next time. And now what we're going to do is return the exams, and if there are any TAs here, I'd appreciate it if they'd come up and help. If you don't want to wait, you can either come after class tonight or starting probably around 8 tonight or tomorrow morning, you can come by my office. They'll be in the hall. You can pick them up. And if you didn't get exam one, you can get that too. Great. You got it, Tom?
Thank you.
Great, I got an army. This is wonderful. It's TA. That's great. I got lots of TA.
Okay, but now we have to get this off. Can you get that off without the baggie? You don't want to kill yourself. That's good.
Nope. Good job. Too good a job.
They worked pretty well.
Yeah, worked really well.
Because they did drop.
Yeah, well, I like this because you can get it on the bottom, too.
Sarah came over
really
with me, too.
Who?
Sarah. She
yeah, good. Good. Okay, so this is... Okay. Okay. So, we're going to start with the morning class, and then if you have the patience to wait, we'll do the afternoon one. Shalom has the morning class A through F. We would appreciate it if you would stay down there because this makes it so much simpler. We would appreciate if the students would stay off the stage, please. It just gets too confusing. Okay? And Justin has G through L. Now, Jesse has M through S, and she's going to go in the back corner there. Okay? And I have T through Z. T through Z. T through Z. Talmont, I can't really read it. Aaron?
Yes.
Tekka? Testani? Teberyatnikova? Timmerman? Tischer? Tran? Turner? Udochi? Uribe? Risselberg, Waterson, Wang, Grace, what is your name? What's your first name? Sherman? Wankel, Waterson, Ward, which one? Scott or Lindsay? Whirlin, Wilder, Williamson, Wu, how? Any more Wus? Wukowitz, Yashinshi, Yegians, Yip, Yoon, Yu, George, Karina, you, Zaya, Zyberberg. Okay. Any more T to Z I didn't get? Rachel? Okay, I got everybody? Okay. Okay. class, both sections, FNC. If anybody's from that, just come over here.
Jim, maybe?
The entire class?
No, I have the entire class, but what I'm going to do is...
Albion?
If I did, what? What?
The average.
The mean the median was, I think, 73 or 74. Okay? A little lower than last time. So this is the evening. This is A through F. How many of you are A through F? Why don't you come up here and tell me your name and I'll fish it out. It takes a while, but I'll do it.
Cole,
C-O-L-E. C-O-L-L?
C-O-L-E.
Amanda.
Bunker.
Phoebe.
Yeah. Thank you.
Barish and Barber. We're probably right there next to it.
Barish and Barber. Okay, let's see what we can do here. Barish and Barber. Yep. That far I can get. I'm not too good at this, but no, you weren't there. Let's see. Barber. Barish.
Canisario?
Cohen? Max. Like your picture? Any more A through F? Round. Adam. There you go. BY? Are you in the evening class?
Yeah.
BY?
BI.
Ah, BI. That spells, that settles that. Okay. That's better. There you go.
Blaine.
Blaine. Any more A to F?
Do you have any more files?
Yeah. Put those down with the thing on it. Okay, so you want... This is the evening class. This is... but let them come up and ask you.
Sure.
This is G... He has... Shalom has G through L of the evening class. I have A to F. What did you say it was?
Driscoll.
Yeah.
Driscoll with a D.
Here you are, Patricia.
Yeah. Thank you. So that T to Z in the morning class.
What?
T to Z?
I did, but I went through it, so you have to wait a minute, and I'll get it for you.
Barber.
I'm EI.
Any more A through F?
Yeah, Rachel.
Hey, who was here from the morning who didn't get theirs?
That's me.
The T through Z?
Yes.
Okay. Would you look through, take the T through Z pile? Do you see that?
That's actually my right.
Hi.
Sarah?
Just a second. Okay. The two T through Zs. What's your last name?
W.
And your first name? I have a bunch of Woos. And what's yours?
What's your name?
Any more T through Z in the morning? No. Okay. So let's see. I think they have all of them.
Sorry, Dajan, did you go through M through S?
No, I didn't.
In the morning?
Yeah. I think this is the morning. Somebody else did, but I can get yours for you. What's your last name?
Marshall.
Dylan?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I still have the evening class.
I do. Yes, I do. What's your last name?
Ariella.
Okay.
She had it.
Mia?
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah.
What is it?
She's from Z.
No, I somebody took it, and I don't know. In the morning? No, the evening I don't have. Just a second. Jesse, do you have the evening?
Or
do you want to split it in half with me?
Sure.
Just pick some letter. Okay. So I have the evening, but I have I think S through Z. S through Z. No, I don't have through Z. I only have S and T. Evening, S and T.
Tang. Tang.
It might still be in there.
Okay, no worries.
I have the list if you didn't get your grade. Daisy?
Yeah.
Anybody else? S through T in the evening?
Where's that? The R. Where's the S for evening?
I think she has them.
S.
I'm sorry to be so slow here. Make you wait around for all this.
The
median, which is what counts, is 73 or 74. S-E-T?
S-E-A-T.
Anybody need the end of the alphabet?
S-H-E-S.
S-H-E-N?
E-S.
I know you, but I don't know your name. Here you are.
It's not a...
That's you?
No, no.
Too bad. You're Schaefer?
Performance issues.
Is it, say again what your last name is?
Sure. S-H-E-A.
Oh, E-A. I thought you said E-N. Okay, here you go. That's still not so bad. Not as good, but it's not so good. Just a second. Let me put this back.
Torres Santos, T-O-R-R-E-S, hyphen,
let's start with Torres.
That's usually enough to look at it.
No, but it isn't here. It's Soros, what's the after that?
Sanchez, S-A-N-C-H-Z, so sometimes it gets...
It might be under Sanchez, because I don't see it under that one. So. You wrote Sanchez.
Thank you.
That's you.
I just said you had S's.
Yes.
No, this isn't it. Torres Santos.
It's Torres Santos. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a plain Santos. I don't see. Are you in the morning class or the evening class? Okay, so it should be in here, but that doesn't mean anything. Oh, here it is. That's you?
Thank you.
Okay. What's your last name?
Suskind.
I have the list of grades, if there's any questions about that. Suskind?
Yep.
I think you were,
yes.
I thought I heard it, but no, it's not right.
I'm just going to turn this off. Before it goes completely.
Jack Rash, I'm going to go to recitation.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
L?
Yeah.
Okay.
For evening or?
Oh, yeah.
I forgot to turn this off.